to Russia. But the United States saw Ukraine as a kind of loose nail under which they placed their weapons. Billions of dollars of weapons, much more than the annual budget of the United Nations, in order to egg Russia on. And by the way, it's not just a matter of Ukraine and Russia coming to some understanding, because they do have to live next to each other. And as Noam was saying, in April of this year, they had an interim agreement which looked a lot like Minsk II, but the West said no. The point, as U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said, is to weaken Russia. You see, the question isn't Ukraine and Russia by itself. It's also the United States and Russia. So when the United States withdrew from the Intermediate Nuclear Force Range Treaty in 2019, that was the end, basically, of most of the arms control treaties between the United States and Russia. In fact, since 2019, we're living without a security guarantee arrangement between these major nuclear powers, the United States and Russia. No wonder that the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has brought the doomsday clock to within 100 seconds of midnight. You know, it began at 7 minutes to midnight. We are now at 100 seconds. And the reason the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists gives for this is the unilateral withdrawal by the United States from basically the entire architecture of arms control with Russia in particular. So there's got to be pressure on the Biden administration, not only to back off and allow Zelensky and Putin to talk, to allow them to have some kind of peace agreement that's, you know, with dignity for all sides, but also the United States needs to go back to the table with the Russians and talk to them. You know, if the United States can talk to the Saudis, in fact, pal up with the Saudis, why can't they talk to the Russians? It's ridiculous to say, you know, the Russians are not going to, they're not a good partner, they're not going to live on agreements and so on. Look who's talking. The United States is the country that unilaterally walked away from the Iran nuclear deal. Not the Iranians, it was the United States. It's a bit rum to now say that, well, the Russians are not a reliable negotiating partner. At least try it. You know, for God's sake, for the sake of humanity, we need these major powers with a lot of firepower in their pocket to talk to each other. You can't turn to the United Nations and say, will you do something? As I said, the UN budget is $3 billion. You've got to strengthen peace building in the world and weaken war making. That has to be part of the commitment of sensitive people around the planet, whether in Russia, in Ukraine, the United States, certainly in the United Kingdom.
You both talk about allowing Russia and Ukraine to negotiate, but how does one do that? And talk about exactly what the U.S. can do now, Professor Chomsky.
What the U.S. can do is stop acting to prevent negotiations. For a long time, there's no time to review the record, but the position of the United States has been to try to undermine possibilities of negotiations.
Professor Chomsky, world-renowned political dissident and linguist, and Vijay Prashad, director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. They've co-authored the new book, The Withdrawal, Iraq, Libya, Afghanistan, and the Fragility of U.S. Power. Noam Chomsky was speaking to us from Brazil. We'll play more of their interview later this week. That does it for our show. On Wednesday, I'll be speaking at Penn State Harrisburg at 7 p.m., and on Thursday, October 6th, at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, at 4 p.m. Democracy Now! Currently is accepting applications for two full-time jobs, an associate digital editor and a people and culture manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with our great journalist friend, Chris Hedges, about the fact that democracy is hanging on by a thread and that only a strong labor movement that strikes and strikes and strikes can help save what is left of American democracy.
You can't have a social movement without democracy. Listen in.
We'll also speak with labor organizer and advocate Alan Benjamin about the state of unionization and workers' rights in America today.
There are grounds, finally, to give us hope. Alan Benjamin's going to talk about recent victories from one end of this country to the other.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
You can't have organized activity for social change without democracy. Social change and democracy are bound up with one another. But America is not a democracy. This is by design. It was never intended to be. The founding fathers, there were no founding mothers, wrote a document 245 years ago in Philadelphia that excluded more Americans than it included. The Supreme Court ruled in the Citizens United case that corporations are people entitled to free speech rights, so they can give as much money as they want to political campaigns. Last month, an industrialist gave $1.6 billion to the Republicans. Like Bob Dylan wrote, money doesn't talk, it swears. It's impossible to have a democracy in a country like ours with such vast income and wealth disparity. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party have a lock on the political process. It is nearly impossible to start a new third party. When Ralph Nader tried it, the Democrats did everything they could to stop him, launching many lawsuits trying to knock him off the state ballots. Since its founding, the ever-growing effects of unlimited money in elections, the partisan gerrymandering of legislative districts, the fraudulent removal of poor and minority voters from voter registration rolls, reduction in the number of voting locations in important minority districts, the unfair advantage given candidates favored by corporate America, including America's corporate media, all combine to leave us with a very unfair and very undemocratic system of governance in America. We speak today with Chris Hedges, the most penetrating journalist we have. He once worked for the New York Times and even won a Pulitzer Prize, but he was forced out. He had a show on RT TV, which was closed down by our government, and some 600 of his shows on Contact were taken off YouTube. Chris Hedges, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Chris, what are the forces that have extinguished American democracy and stripped its citizens of economic and political power?
So I would say they're primarily economic. We saw since the early 1970s, the Powell memo lays this out, an assault by the ruling business elites and oligarchs against all of those popular movements that had wrested power back from the ruling class into the hands of the population, the feminist movement, the anti-war movement, the Black Power movement, AIM, the Indian Native American movement. And this was a concerted effort to consolidate not only power but wealth in the hands of a very rapacious oligarchic elite. It included, of course, an assault against unions, strikes being the one mechanism that people have to cripple and bring down a ruling class. Less than 10% of our, or roughly 10% of our workforce is unionized. I think only 6% in the private sector. And then through a series of anti-union legislation, beginning with the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act, It makes it extremely difficult to organize and actually carry out strikes. So it was a multi-pronged assault. It led to this obscene consolidation of wealth on the part of the ruling elite, but that wasn't, of course, enough. They seized political power, turning the electoral process into something that is virtually little more than legalized bribery. So all of this combined to really destroy American democracy and American democratic institutions. Of course, we can't ignore deindustrialization, the shipping of jobs overseas to, in essence, sweatshops in China, Bangladesh, and Vietnam, the rise of the gig economy. All of these forces work together to essentially create, I don't think we live in a functioning democracy anymore, and we stand on the cusp of a very naked fascism. We're not alone, as we just saw in Sweden. Marie Le Pen pulling 41% of the vote in France, in Bulgaria, Poland, Hungary. This is, of course, a reaction to the same neoliberal and globalist forces throughout the world with the same kinds of results. It's a tilting towards fascism, which we saw in the 1930s, and unfortunately the left, particularly in the United States, which was able to carry out a series of major strikes that forced Roosevelt into passing New Deal legislation, is virtually non-existent. So we're in big trouble.
Mm-hmm. You know, Chris, as evidence of that, the world bodies that rank democracies in the world now has placed the United States, in one case 26th, one case 28th, and list us now as a partial democracy. And many historians are warning us that we may be on the cusp of losing what little is left of our democracy here in this country and soon become an authoritarian country, or worse. I wonder, do you share that view? And if so, what do you think the social forces are that may have us on the precipice of becoming an authoritarian country?
Yeah, because it's been a long process, which was also true in Weimar Germany. So if you look at the 1928 elections in Germany, the Nazi Party polled less than 3%. Then came the global financial crash of 1929. Unemployment soared. The Weimar government was tone deaf to massive unemployment. In fact, they cut unemployment insurance in order to meet debt obligations. The Weimar itself had been dysfunctional for a long time, going all the way back to 1919 under Ebert and later Bruning. They largely ruled by decree to bypass a very fractious parliament. This was Article 48 of the Weimar Constitution. But we're really no different in terms of the only way to get things done is our executive orders, which were liberally used by Obama and Trump and Biden to bypass our own legislative impasse. The courts, as was true after 1933 in Germany, have been seized by extremists. Look at the Supreme Court. The press has siloed itself into bifurcated and competing antagonistic tribes, appealing to one demographic and demonizing the other. Dialogue, compromise, these are the twin pillars of a democratic system, don't exist. So the step, which was true in Weimar, which I think will be true here, from the kind of pretense or the appearance of a functioning democracy into a form of authoritarianism is actually a very short step.
When you have as many states as we have, pivotal states in elections, passing the kind of laws that they've passed that allow the new people in charge of elections, in charge of deciding who the electors will actually be, there's a good belief that the 2024 election, whoever actually wins it, will decide because of this that the Republican candidate has won it, and that it's that quick that we could become that autocracy. Do you share that view, or is that alarmist, do you think?
No, I certainly share that view, although it's not just the fact that they're rigging the election system. I would have to say Goldman Sachs and Raytheon and Bank of America have already rigged it. They've rigged it in favor of the ruling oligarchs in the Democratic and the Republican Party, which interestingly have essentially fused into one party.
Speaking of the Democratic Party, Biden has talked about our pending loss of democracy. Other Democrats have done the same. But do you believe that the Democratic Party can save what little is left of our democracy?
No. On all of the major issues, trade deals, wholesale government surveillance, insane amounts of money pumped into the war industry, $15 billion given to fund the proxy war in Ukraine. There really is very little difference. And these two ruling parties are responsible for the assault against democracy and democratic institutions, whether it's Citizens United or anything else. So they're so frightened of even the most tepid efforts at reform. That was evidenced in how they made sure that Bernie Sanders was not going to be the nominee. And then, in fact, the major donors, Lloyd Blankfein, who'd been the CEO of Goldman Sachs, publicly stated that if Sanders somehow got the nomination, they would vote for Trump. So, these parties are, and this has, of course, been the failure, I think, on many well-meaning people, is that they have invested their hope and time into a system and a Democratic Party that's not reformable.
This is Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, Jim Lafferty. We're speaking with Chris Hedges. Chris, you spoke last Saturday at a rally in Berkeley, California, in support of Julian Assange, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and the Palestinians. What's the connection between these three people and movements? And is there an indication, because of this rally, that the various movements on the left can work together and consolidate leadership and organization?
Well, the left is, and this, has been decades in the making, but the left has really been so marginalized and crippled, and I think without union organization, which we don't have, and the ability to strike, which is the one weapon that the working class has that can actually wrest power from a ruling elite, were pretty much defanged. The connection between Mumia, who I visited in Frackville, and of course Julian, who I used to visit in the embassy in Ecuador, is that they're both journalists. We forget that Mumia was the leading black journalist in Philadelphia at a time when police killings were rampant. In fact, the federal government had to intervene. The Philadelphia Police Department was just so murderous. And so he was long a target in the way that Julian was a target. And I think if we look closely at the judicial proceedings that condemned Mumia to death row, and he's now serving life without parole, he's off death row, or Julian, they are just so filled with holes as to be risible. They're not actual judicial proceedings, they're lynchings. So that's the connection between those two. And then, of course, the Palestinians, everybody is wringing their hands over the suffering of Ukrainians, and I certainly empathize with that suffering, having covered war for 20 years. But this gets into what Chomsky and Ed Herman called worthy and unworthy victims, the suffering of the Palestinians, which as the Palestinian people have been enduring an illegal occupation under international law since 1948. Gaza is the largest open-air prison in the world. The restrictions on Palestinians match the restrictions on blacks during apartheid, with this exception. I don't believe that the white apartheid government of South Africa ever sent fighter warplanes to bomb the townships. So I think these are both the suffering of the Palestinians, the suffering of Assange and Mumia, two incredibly courageous truth tellers. That's an example of how selective our judicial and our political system is in terms of addressing egregious crimes against the innocent.
Chris, you of course have written about the loss of democracy already in America and how little is left and America was not really a fully, of course, democratic nation at the get-go. But you've written well about that, and we were talking about it again, of course, today. But I'm wondering, to what extent do you see the democracy that has already been lost, the state of little democracy that we now find ourselves existing in, to what extent does that influence those organizations and movements that are trying to fight against it? How are they already under a disadvantage, if you will, when they try to fight to save democracy or advance the progressive clause because of what has already happened to our democracy?
Well, there are, of course, so many restrictions. We can begin with money. You can't even run for a House seat unless you can raise at least $1 million. I think the Hillary Clinton's campaign cost $1 billion. And all of these politicians on both sides of the aisle, when they get to Congress, they're beholden to the people who funded them, which is why the lobbyists literally write the legislation, submit it to the congressional offices, and then it goes through committee and becomes law. So there's a paralysis within the system. The very aggressive tactics that are used by both parties to lock out third-party candidates. I worked with Ralph Nader on his campaign, so I saw that up close, the way they demonized Jill Stein as a Russian agent. So locking them out of the debates. I mean, and you can't raise the money to get commercial airtime. So the entire electoral system has seized up to such an extent that there's no room for any kind of reform or the rise of any new parties or candidates that will begin to address the grotesque social inequality and the rigged system that we live in. And the press, of course, is controlled by roughly a half dozen corporations, Comcast and Viacom, and et cetera, who have no intention of allowing critical voices, Noam Chomsky being perhaps the premier example, from questioning power and how it works. So all the way around, they've essentially locked out legitimate political grassroots movements, and I would say even demonized them.
Chris Hedges, what role do you believe that Trump, who's very good at using fear and lies to get support and arouse his supporters to engage in often illegal actions, what role do you think that Trump is likely to play in any struggle to prevent America from becoming an authoritarian country?
Well, Trump isn't really ultimately the problem. Trump was an echo chamber for the radical right, and most of his talking points he got from listening to Rush Limbaugh and Savage and all these other right-wing radio talk show hosts. In fact, it was such flagrant plagiarism that they began to just send him the talking points during the campaign. So he responds. He's a response to something that's already there. And I, a decade ago, wrote a book on the Christian right called American Fascist, The Christian Right and the War in America. And if it's not Trump, it will be Pompeo or Tom Cotton or the governor of Florida, or who knows. And of course, they're seeing the establishment political parties are working quite energetically to essentially prevent Trump from mounting another campaign through criminal proceedings. They've already banned him from social media. But this isn't going to solve the problem. Trump's not the problem. Trump is a result of the problem. Trump is a symptom, but he's not the disease. And the Democratic Party has failed under the Biden administration to address the underlying causes that are pushing people both in the United States and Europe into the arms of these proto-fascist movements. He can't even raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. His Build Back Better bill is gutted. So the ineffectiveness on the part of the ruling class to address the very legitimate anger and misery and hopelessness and despair that is rippling across the country is going to feed fascism or our version of it with or without Trump.
Yeah, and so I guess that brings us to the ultimate question, or the pivotal question, certainly, that we want to talk about. and are talking about in various ways today, and it leads to this question. Given how limited American democracy has become, given the forces against it that you've discussed so well, given the fact that there are, though, at least people who are now talking about it, it is being discussed openly. There are groups in the country, of course, fighting for democratic reforms and for the saving of democracy. But as you evaluate the situation, then, do you have much hope that what's left of American democracy can, in fact, be saved?
Well, there's a great quote from Alexander Herzen, speaking to a bunch of anarchists who wanted to overthrow the czar, and he said, it's not our job to save a dying system, but replace it. We're not the doctors. We are the disease, to quote Harrison. And that's right. I think the one weapon that offers any hope are strikes, because strikes are the weapon that can bring down any ruling class. I mean, the Russian Revolution, for instance, in February, started with a strike of 130,000 workers. Lenin was in Switzerland. It caught, in fact, the professional revolutionaries by surprise. Trotsky was in New York. It is essentially a beleaguered working class, and there'll have to be wildcat strikes because of the labor laws. We may still have a railroad strike, which would be catastrophic to the economy with a weak supply chain and inflation as it is. This is where my hope lies, that workers, which will unite across the political spectrum under the understanding that it is a kind of class war. That's where I place my hope, and I think it's where the left should place their energy.
So, Chris, how do we get from where we're at now to where we want to be? What are the next steps? How do you envision where we should be going?
Well, I think it comes with an understanding of power, of what Sheldon Wolin called our system of inverted totalitarianism, and by crippling the foundations of power. And that comes, as I said earlier, through essentially mass mobilization and strikes, which the ruling oligarchs fear deeply, which is why they have mounted this decades-long assault on labor unions, going all the way back, of course, to the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947. I mean, the income inequality is not like anything we have ever seen. In 1928, the top 10% held 23.9% of the nation's wealth, and that was a percentage that declined until 1973. And then with this concerted assault by the oligarchic elite in the early 70s, we have now ended up where the top 10% of the richest people in the country own almost 70% of the country's wealth. The top 1% control 31%. And meanwhile, the bottom 50% of the U.S. population have 2% of the U.S. wealth. Go all the way back to Aristotle's Politics. That kind of income inequality, as Aristotle writes, breeds either tyranny or revolution. That's our choice. But my hope lies with using the weapon of the strike, because that is the most effective weapon the working class has, and it can do real damage to any ruling elite.
Chris Hedges, before we have to say goodbye, what are your final thoughts, please?
Well, I'm worried about what the very pronounced rise of neo-fascism, both in the United States and Europe, and the inability on the part of a left and a liberal class that has been defanged to push back. Europe, Spain, Germany, Italy, they went one way in the 1930s and we went another. And it wasn't because of the benevolence of Roosevelt and the ruling class. It was because of strikes and union unrest that pushed Roosevelt to adopt the New Deal. We never forget that we had a very homegrown fascist movement in the United States, backed by people like Henry Ford and others, open admirers of Mussolini because he had neutered the unions in Italy. But while we're seeing so many similarities to the 1930s, what is not similar is that we don't have a militant left to protect us. And that's my big fear.
Well, Chris, we do thank you so very much. I wonder, how can our listeners learn more about your work, your thinking on this issue and others?
It's chrishedges.substack.com.
All right. That is wonderful, Chris.
Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Great. Yeah, thanks for doing it.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
When the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run, there can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
It is we who plow the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. Now we stand outcast and starving mid the wonders we have made, but the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever.
Taken untold millions that they never toil to earn, but without our brain and muscle, not a single wheel can turn. We can break their haughty power, gain our freedom when we learn that the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever.
In our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of atoms magnified a thousandfold. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old, for the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever.
For decades now, only about 11% of workers in America have been members of unions, whereas previously more than 35% were union members. Various pieces of pro-management legislation and court opinions caused this diminution in union membership, and as a consequence, a weakening of the rights of American workers and of unions. But in recent years, as a result of a militant fight-back effort by exploited workers in many industries, unions have once again been having some success in organizing efforts at various workplaces, such as a few of the Amazon warehouses or a couple of Starbucks stores, Apple and Trader Joe's and the like. But federal and state laws still create an uphill fight for those seeking to organize workers into unions and, well, to win good labor contracts. So today we ask, do these few but growing number of recent labor union victories truly represent a new day for American workers and the unions that serve them? Do these localized labor victories suggest that more and bigger victories for workers are now within reach? Or have these recent victories been simply exceptions to the still dismal overall state of union organizing in America? Are either of the two capitalist political parties sufficiently committed to advancing the right of workers to organize unions? Or is an independent political movement or party needed to make the significant union and workers' gains that workers' rights advocates work for? And what about the pending threat of a nationwide railroad workers' strike? And if the railroad companies and their workers cannot reach a negotiated settlement acceptable to the railway workers, could President Biden step in and use the Railway Labor Act in an effort to prevent
a railway strike and its devastating consequences for the U.S. economy. Well, to help us answer these and other questions about the current and future state of union organizing efforts, we couldn't have a better guest than our guest today. He is Alan Benjamin. Alan Benjamin is a longtime union organizer and workers' advocate. He is a leader in his own union. He has served on the Executive Council of the San Francisco AFL-CIO Labor Council. He is also one of the principal organizers of the organization known as Labor and Community for an Independent Party, or LCIP. Alan Benjamin, a warm welcome to the Law and Disorder radio show, my friend.
Thank you. Glad to be on the show. Thanks for inviting me.
Alan, what about it? Are these recent victories at a few of the Amazon shops or the Starbucks places, Trader Joe's and the like, is that evidence really that today's labor movement is once again on the ascendancy, or should we be careful not to read too much into these victories, get too excited about it? Nevertheless small, but nevertheless important victories.
Well, I think it's fair to say, and it's not inaccurate to say, that there is an incredible labor resurgence. Not always translated in victories, but definitely a fight back, strikes the likes of which we haven't seen in decades. And some victories here and there. We can get into what the obstacles are to victories.
And we will do that.
But the if you look to Chipotle workers, 100,000 of them in Michigan, or nationally, but in Michigan, they vote to form a union and have a national caucus formed already, a national organizing committee for Chipotle workers. Starbucks, Apple, Trader Joe's, REI, Amazon at Staten Island, the workers, National Union of Healthcare Workers, mental health care workers, 6 weeks out on strike against Kaiser here in California, St. Vincent Hospital, nursery home workers, the largest private sector nurses strike just completed in Oregon. There's just no question about it. And that coupled with the resurgence of rank and file movements within a lot of the more conservative unions. We've seen the Teamsters for Democratic Union take over the helm of the Teamsters Union, Sean O'Brien, militant leadership. Not to prettify too much, but it reflects a movement from below, from within the union. By the way, a lot of these youth organizing drives in Chipotle and other places, Starbucks, are forming their own independent unions, or many of them joining mostly Teamsters right now. Teamsters 243 was the Chipotle workers. And what we're seeing is a delayed reaction to the upsurge that resulted 10 years ago. Exactly 10 years ago this week with the Chicago teachers. They kind of set the example and the way forward by working with the community, dispelling that whole idea that, you know, unions are just out for themselves. For number one, they don't care about other workers, they don't care about the communities. They showed that the issue of teachers and education is not just the teachers or the education workers, but the whole community. Social justice unionism, bargaining for the common good is what they called it. And that saw and ignited a movement in Los Angeles. You had some of the biggest, most important strikes in a long time, and with some very clear victories in UTLA, Oklahoma, Arizona, these red states where teachers, you know, you wondered, you know, have they been dormant all these years? And they said, no, we're here, presente. Then one particular struggle that I've been very actively involved in is the strike of the detained workers in the ICE centers, ICE detention centers in California in the Central Valley. They're being paid $1 a day to do all the work that was performed by janitors and staff that were laid off just to increase the profits of the GO, a private prison, and the big boys that run these corporations. It's now these for-profit prisons. And so they get rid of paid unionized workers, and they ask and they demand that the detainees clean, scrub, do the dishes, do the bathrooms, do the floors, and without proper sanitary equipment. They're paid $1 a day, and they said, we're not doing this, and we're the strike is igniting across the country. We're going to be part of that movement. And the three different detainees, detention centers, have joined them in the strike. So this is it's kind of exciting, mostly Latino workers, people who've been picked up because they don't have papers, and rather than being deported, they fill the quotas in the prison so that the tax money from taxpayers goes to fund.
Have various federal anti-worker, anti-union organizing laws like Taft-Hartley in 1947, have they played a major role in why unions have had less success organizing workers into unions than was once the case?
Oh, no question about it. That's why they were instituted to curb the massive uprising of the 1930s and of that post-war period in 1946, which was the biggest nationwide strike wave, I think, in the history of the United States. Yeah, these laws have curtailed the right to organize. That right exists on paper, but in reality, they had the sequestered meetings with the bosses, no ability to get car check or car check neutrality. Countless. The Railway Act was instituted as part of this effort, which would have to prevent workers from striking key sectors, key economic sectors. And by the way, the issue of the rail worker strike is not over. Mm-hmm. This is not over. Right. They come to a tentative agreement, but the workers have to vote, and they are angry. They're angry with the deal. They're angry with their leadership that cut a deal. They're angry with Biden that stepped in at the last minute to tell them, you ain't striking. We got to work this out. And labor management cooperation's the way to go. And the workers know that that usually means cuts and layoffs and attacks. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the laws have been a major thing. All these Democrats all promise that they're going to get rid of Taft-Hartley, at least with the major sections or major portions of it. We heard that from Obama. The Employee Free Choice Act was going to be the response to Taft-Hartley. And then Biden, supposedly the friend of labor, the best friend that labor's ever had, according to Kamala Harris, he promises the PRO Act, which would have obliterated Taft-Hartley, and doesn't go to the mat to fight for it. He raises it at a rally here and there, all PR, but he doesn't fight for it. He doesn't advocate for it. He hides behind the filibuster and Manchin to say, well, we don't have the votes.
Right. Alan, that leads to, in fact, my next question, and that's perfect lead into it, really, because there are many in the labor movement, I know you've certainly been one of them, who have argued for years now that the two capitalist political parties in America simply can't be trusted or counted on to advance the rights of workers to form unions, bargain for better wages, working conditions, and the like. And 5 years ago, the National AFL-CIO at its convention, in fact, adopted a resolution calling for the opening of a discussion within the union regarding whether there was not, in fact, a need for a labor party to be formed. But what, if anything, has been the result of that resolution?
Not much. In fact, nothing at all. It was a resolution that was coupled with a workshop and a meeting at the AFL-CIO convention in 2017 to talk about it. Mark Dimenstein, president of the Postal Workers Union, another radical militant leader, raised this. It was adopted. But what happens in all of these things when good legislation, or excuse me, not legislation, when good proposals come to the fore and it's time to implement them, they say, well, now's not the time. It's just not the time. We have other priorities. We have to get rid of Trump. We have to get rid of, it goes way back. The labor movement knows that the question of subordination to the Democratic Party is a problem, or sectors do. But they're not going to do anything about it because it's, again, the lesser evilism business. We have to put our demands on hold to get, you know, the better people in office. And we've said for decades, Mike probably remembers this better than anyone, campaigning around, you know, the issue of, you know, the workers can't get into the ring and fight with one arm behind their back, tied behind their back. We need the political voice of working people, and we actually gave it a shot in 1996 with the formation of the Labor Party. Tony Mazzocchi and OCAW, Oil, Chemical, and Common Workers Union, founded a Labor Party, not a shabby outfit representing 2 million workers, ILWU, among many others, mostly old CIA union, CIO unions, excuse me. No, this is the better wing. You can say that of others, but this was the better wing. But never run candidates, never wanted to challenge the Democrats or run against them. It became nothing more than a pressure group on the Democratic Party, and it fizzled as a result. You know, people didn't see its usefulness. If it was about campaigns for single payer or others, ad hoc committees like Labor Campaign for Single Payer or U.S. Labor Against the War or countless others would suffice. There was no need for a Labor Party that didn't get into the ring against the Democrats. And so for a lot of people, the idea of a Labor Party, we tried it, didn't work, let's do something else. Many of us said we didn't really try it. We have to go through that process because labor, the working class, 13, 14, 15 million people, depending on what statistics you use, represent a powerful potential movement. Already, just you see the fear that the Wall Street Journal and The Economist and others exhibited when they saw that the rail workers were about to strike. It would paralyze, you know, the entire delivery of a third of the nation's commerce. And so, yeah, you know, they were saying, "Oh no, my God!" And they're still warning that the strike could continue. That there could be a strike. The machinists, 5,000 of them that have a contract with the railway, voted to reject the contract. So many of us have decided we're going to continue the fight for the Labor Party because that's a fundamental battle that needs to be won. And we formed Labor and Committee for an Independent Party with a number of the leaders of the Labor Party who had over the years, like us, like me and others, advocated for running candidates locally and building from the bottom up. So we're glad that we're keeping a little bit of that thread and a little bit of that hope alive.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host, Jim Lafferty. We're speaking with labor leader Alan Benjamin. Alan, let's talk about broad community support. How important is it for strike winning and forming a union to begin with? How successful can you be without that broad community support?
You can't be. You simply can't be anymore. You don't have the specific weight of 35 to 40% organized labor. You don't have laws which enabled you to actually go on strike. You don't have, so you need to build the community support. Take Amazon and the defeat at Bessemer in Alabama. They brought in all the big organizers from the North. They brought in all the people who were supposed to know everything about strikes and organizing. They didn't involve the community, the black community in the region. They were outsiders. They were not involved. This was a factory that was comes from outside with people who are organizing it who come from not from our community. How are they going to win? How are they going to win? What Chicago did is it showed that you can win, and they won by building, organizing patiently in the community. Organizing labor community speakouts, assemblies, going door to door, working with them, interviewing with families, getting them to speak on the issues. And they had a tremendous success in this. One of the organizers, Jane Bruskin, just recounts the tremendous enthusiasm that was generated in Chicago around the strike. And frankly, there's reasons why people are turned off by the unions. You know, they just see these, you know, white men mostly, not paying attention to their issues, thinking about number one, concerned only about the paycheck and not about conditions that face their communities. And so what's exciting about a lot of these new organizing drives is it's diverse young kids, Black, Latino, Filipino, Asian American organizing, and saying we're part of the community and we're not doing this without the community.
Alan Benjamin, I'm familiar with the fact that the Democratic Party in South Carolina is not keen on your organization, the Labor and Community for an Independent Party, running candidates in that state. Tell us about this, and is the South Carolina Democratic Party an exception to the rule?
Not an exception. The background, the Labor Party that existed from 1996 to 2007, when it was they closed shop because, you know, people weren't coming around. Unions were disaffiliating it. They were getting nothing out of it. But one of the things that positive that did develop, and out of pressure from the ranks that had formed the chapters of the Labor Party, was the formation of the South Carolina Labor Party as a statewide party that registered as an elected electoral party, had ballot status, had to run candidates every 4 years and have a certain percentage of the vote to remain on the ballot, which it did. And they've been running candidates. They've been keeping the issue of the Labor Party front and center in South Carolina, which is not the heaviest industrial base. It's 1% organized workers in South Carolina are in unions. But nonetheless, it built ties with the community, especially the Black community. And it was, it was not on hold. It was really actually organizing. But it had a breath of fresh air come in with a decision by one of the Democratic Party candidates for governor, who got so fed up with the Democrats for not supporting $15 an hour, not for not supporting Medicaid improvement, Medicare for All, the Democratic Party's very own platform. And Gary Voltour said, I'm leaving and I'm going to run as a candidate for the Labor Party. And I'm going to promote the Labor Party. We need a Labor Party. These Democrats are pathetic. I know. I've been there. I was involved in all the mechanisms of the Democratic Party in South Carolina. And that's when it hit the fan. The Democrats went ballistic. They filed a lawsuit to prevent the candidates from appearing on the ballot. The state election committee ruled that there was no basis for keeping them off the ballot, three candidates of the South Carolina Labor Party, with the support of LCIP, Labor and Community for an Independent Party. And the Democratic Party continued with this lawsuit and demanded, got a judge to rule them off the ballot. This was filed by the Democratic Party, but also with the support of the South Carolina AFL-CIO, which said, you know, maybe sometime that would be good to have our own candidates, but not now and not in 2024 and probably, you know, never. It's pretty much never. We were disappointed that Gary didn't decide to run as a write-in candidate because he had such publicity and such amount of interest in his campaign. The papers were following day to day the court proceedings, the judge's ruling, and then you've had the big backlash by all across the country. People who've seen this said the Democrats are scared of the South Carolina Labor Party, you know, and the answer is yeah, because as small as it is and as insignificant as many people might think of South Carolina, it opened the door. It opened a crack in the door for people to say, wow, this idea is viable. Look at what's happening in South Carolina. There's a candidate, high-profile, well-known, revered candidate, saying we need to build our own party. At a time when the polls show that people are disenchanted, disenfranchised with the Democrats. They're tired. They're a lot more independents than ever, and, of course, independents can be more conservative and some can be more radical. But what we're saying in LCIP is these independents are going to go to the right if they don't see an alternative develop independently. So it's a great time to be organizing for a Labor Party, as contradictory as that might appear to be. So you just have to keep plugging.
Yeah, you know, Alan, we were speaking with Chris Hedges, who was Ralph Nader's speechwriter, and the Democratic Party did the same thing to Ralph Nader to keep him off the ballot. But let me just switch our line of inquiry here for a moment and ask you about foreign policy. How would you evaluate the position of the American labor movement when it comes to speaking out on issues of U.S. foreign policy? For example, have they taken a position on the U.S. support for the war in Ukraine, or any stand on the alleged Israeli war crimes in Gaza or the occupied territories, or just recently on the more than $800 billion that the U.S. defense budget claimed out of our pockets? What has been the position of the labor movement on that?
Disastrous, right-wing, just shameful, and that's putting it nicely. You can't touch the issue of Ukraine. You can pass resolutions, as have occurred in many unions, denouncing Russia for intervening and for invading. And in my opinion, there's a basis for that, but only if you put the accent on the NATO and the United States for instigating the whole thing. And you cannot do that. You cannot challenge. They've been put on anybody who's presented these resolutions, and I know three or four that have appeared across the country, are told that is contrary to AFL-CIO policy. In our own labor council, we had a resolution opposing the banning of six Palestinian human rights and labor organizations in the West Bank. And it took us 1 year of internal struggle to win that resolution. And we did have a little bit of an opening with the AFL-CIO giving us the green light nationally to endorse this resolution. But overall, Ukraine, you can't touch. China and dealing with the very imminent the threats against China, which are increasing by the day, you can't go there. When the Western Massachusetts AFL-CIO adopted a good resolution focusing their ire on NATO and the U.S. and the buildup, saying that it's $800 billion, well, $780 maybe at the time, the buildup at the expense of schools and highways and education and health care, they were told, no way. Is this going to, and they had submitted it to the state AFL-CIO and the national, we're shutting this down. We're shutting this resolution down, and the local leadership buckled because they were told that that's essentially being anti-union. We have a hell of a challenge. Our unions have a terrible legacy, AFLD and the rest, for cooperating with the CIA. Our unions have a very soiled history of collaboration with right-wing regimes in Latin America, for example, Pinochet and others, to squelch independent unions and progressive movements. They have been at the arm, tied at the hip of the two ruling class parties in implementing these heinous policies. And so that's the legacy. There's no discussion available to have a balance sheet of that period, and in many ways it continues till today.
Alan, I wonder, we're listening to you and we've learned so much, I have. Where can our listeners learn more about your work, the work of the labor and community for an independent labor party and such?
LCIP Committee, one word, lcipcommittee.org or socialistorganizer.org. Also, we publish a newsletter weekly.
Ah, wonderful. Thank you, Alan. Alan Benjamin, thank you for the informative, really informative and wise discussion today by you. We thank you so much for joining us, really, on Law and Disorder.
Thanks to both of you for keeping movement in the movement, you know.
Alan Benjamin, you take it easy.
Okay, thanks, Mike. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Jim.
Just to remind our listeners, if they didn't get it the first time, Alan Benjamin said that the way to get a hold of him is lcipcommittee.org or socialistorganizing.org. And that's the way you can reach Alan Benjamin.
Pose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT in sound from way out.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Flavor since 1940.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
You know, what's at stake here is not whether your kid's going to go to college or get a good job. What's at stake here is whether democracy is going to survive. And that makes it very clear how crucial public education is. And I put the word on public because let's be clear here. The attack on education is not because it's failing. The attack on education is because it's public. It's a public good.
That's Henry Giroux, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Henry Giroux on the attack on public education. These are difficult times for public education. It is under political attack by what noted educator and scholar Henry Giroux calls the apostles of authoritarianism. Professor Giroux says public schools, more than ever, are subject to the toxic forces of privatization and mindless standardized curricula, while teachers are de-skilled and subject to intolerable labor conditions, not unlike Walmart workers. Unfortunately, public and higher education now mimic a business culture run by a managerial army of bureaucrats more suited to work as accountants in pencil factories than in schools. At the same time, Professor Giroux continues, all levels of education are under attack by right-wing politicians who are censoring history, forbidding discussions about racism, eliminating tenure, and imposing enormous restrictions on teacher autonomy. Our guest today is Henry Giroux, a prominent public intellectual, prolific writer, commentator, and scholar. He teaches at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. He's a founding theorist of critical pedagogy. Among his many books are Neoliberalism's War on Higher Education, The Violence of Organized Forgetting, and America at War with Itself. And now, Henry Giroux.
Across the globe, democratic institutions such as the independent media, schools, the legal system, certain financial institutions, and higher education are under siege. The promise and ideals of democracy are receding as right-wing extremists breathe new life into a fascist past and undermine what I call the public imagination. Reinventing a sordid fascist legacy with its obsession with racial purity, white nationalism, and the denial of civil liberties, white supremacists are once more on the move, subverting language, values, courage, vision, and critical consciousness. Education has increasingly become a tool of domination as right-wing pedagogical apparatuses controlled by the entrepreneurs of hate attack workers, the poor, people of color, refugees, undocumented immigrants, LGBTQ people, and others increasingly considered disposable. In the midst of an era when an older social order is crumbling and a new one is struggling to define itself, there emerges a time of confusion, danger, and moments of great restlessness. The present moment, once again, is at an historical juncture in which the structures of liberation and authoritarianism, fascism and democracy are vying for a future that appears to either be unthinkable, an unthinkable nightmare, or a realizable dream. We now live in a world that resembles a dystopian novel. Since the late 1970s, a form of what I call gangster capitalism, or what can be called neoliberalism, has waged war on the welfare state, public goods, and the social contract. Neoliberalism believes that the market should govern not just the economy, but all aspects of society. All relationships are now commercialized. It concentrates